Welcome, everyone, to episode 86 of Underserved. Joining me in studio today is David Rose, an author and serial entrepreneur from Boston. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
David, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Andrew.
So growing up in the Midwest, like, was it hard to kind of get access to technology?
Well, I went to a summer camp and we had a robot there, which you could program. I think it was in assembly, so it wasn't easy.
Brutal.
To change its behavior. That's right. But I did kind of get the bug of being able to program behaviors into something that would iteratively move around or draw kind of spirograph patterns. And I got excited about programming in general. And, you know, I think I had a Commodore 64 at the time. The options were BASIC, and I think you could do a little bit of Pascal, or I got an Apple IIe. You know, that was just magic to be able to think of something, be able to describe it in code, and then, you know, make super rudimentary video games. But that was one of my passions at the time.
And you'd see it manifest and you're like, I have given life.
Exactly. And the spell check, you know, as a little bit of dyslexic, a little bit of ADHD, like I totally needed the spell check. So that was also helpful.
Very nice. So you end up going to college in a small liberal arts school in the area?
Yeah, I went up to St. Olaf College, which is a great little school just south of Minneapolis. In a small pond like that, you're able to be a big fish. And I was a physics major. I also had a fine arts major, and I also sang, was a tenor in one of the choirs there. They have a really good music program. So it was kind of a thrill to be able to do all of those things. I could be photo editor at the Manitou Messenger at the time, too. So I think actually for boys that develop a little bit late, going to a liberal arts school where you're not sure what you want to be, but you still can dabble in lots of areas was really super generative for me.
Now, did you have an easier time with spoken languages or computer languages?
Oh, actually, the way that I got out of my language requirements was I wrote some software. The Macintosh had just come out, and I got a box that could digitize. And so we could have native speakers that were speaking mostly Scandinavian languages, because St. Olaf is a patron saint of Norway. So we created a 14 floppy disk program called MacNorsk. and actually, it went to market. Like, they sold some copies of it. And actually, the way I got my first job after college was I took that language learning program to a conference up in Toronto and got a job at Oberlin College in the Academic Computing Center, writing more software for profs. So it was a good thing to venture into.
You also did some animations of the Malleus, Incus, and Stapes.
I'm sure everyone knows the Malleus, Incus, and Stapes. One of my jobs before going to Oberlin College was I grew up in Madison, and my dad was a doc and introduced me to some researchers there that were at the medical school. And one of the phenomena that they were having a hard time explaining to new doctors was the way that the middle ear and the inner ear work. And seeing an animation of those textbooks gave you a sense of the pivoting and vibration patterns of how that system works. So I looked at a lot of medical textbooks and anatomy. These are the three tiniest bones of the body, and then tried to use 3D modeling software. This was like way before Maya or one of the good NURB-based systems, and to create those three little bones of the ear and kind of illustrate for medical students how they pivoted and made animations of those things. So I am not a 3D animator. That was not a career thing, but I was kind of, after a physics major, you're kind of fearless.
I did some computer animation in college and TA'd a grad level course on it. And it was difficult back then. It's, I assume, like 80s, 90s era.
Yeah, this was a 99, right after graduation. So 90, 91. The hardest thing was just the render time. I had my first little company I started about that time. And I think we had about 12 employees and about 12 Macs that I had bought. And there was some software that would distribute the rendering across Macs on a local network. So made it a little bit faster, but still you were up late listening to the Seagulls, which come out in the Boston Seaport area. at about 3 or 4 a.m. So, you know, like dawn is coming. We were down in a loft space. I got this Boston Wharf Company who owns most of that land down there in the seaport. I negotiated a 5-year lease on a 4,000 square foot loft space for $4 a square foot, going to $5 a square foot over 5 years. It was really bare space. And I installed a tub and was living there for a while. They slid a note under my door one day and said, please show us proof of your other residential address. So I had to get a place on Beacon Hill.
So that was Interactive Factory?
Yeah, that's right. The vision was, how do you create a kind of a collective or consortium or kibbutz or whatever of people who could all put together multimedia projects? So we did a project for WGBH, a bunch of animations for Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego? Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
and we got a project with Boston Museum of Science to do an exhibit on scanning electron microscopy. And I realized early on that I wasn't the 3D animator, nor was I the sound designer, nor was I the video editor, I was really more of a producer and a little bit of a hacker. And so I tried to surround myself with other people who had those complementary skills. And, you know, we really didn't know what we were doing at the time. We didn't have a salary system. Mostly it was, let's just all split the rent together and see if we can win some projects from museums and some publishing companies. We worked for Houghton Mifflin and Simon & Schuster and Addison Wesley on kind of language learning textbooks or the software that goes with the language learning textbook.
That's pretty gutsy right out of school to start something yourself. A lot of people go cut their teeth at a big company and make mistakes on someone else's dime. What did you learn from that experience?
Yeah, I'm not sure what the real practical skills of being a fine arts and physics major are, but I think they do teach you, maybe the physics major most of all, to kind of just be fearless about kind of figuring out stuff in the world. And I was always super fired up about, you know, how could we use new technologies to create environments to help people learn? Like, that was just my passion. Like, SimCity was out at the time. I was taking classes at the Media Lab at MIT in the Interactive Cinema Group, which was a really amazing set of people kind of trying to figure out, how do you take digital film and make movies that wouldn't know exactly how they ended? Like, the idea was they would have like limited look ahead. So they'd like a good conversation. They would kind of have algorithms that would put together the film as you went forward. So I was fired up about those ideas. I worked with Lego on a project where we embedded technology into Lego bricks, and which eventually became the Lego Mindstorms project, doing museum exhibit design. I mean, I was just swimming in this really exciting pool of a mixture of kind of ideas all powered by computation in some way. And like, why would I go work for a huge company when I can do that instead?
But you did learn a few business lessons there as well about life is much easier when your customers have a lot of money.
Yeah, good point. I have a huge passion for working with publishing companies and museums, but they do have this feature, which is they often don't have large budgets, but they do have a lot of people and opinions. So it's very hard to be finished with one of those projects. You know, there's always somebody else that has a good idea to how to make it a little bit better. And then you're also, if it's installed in like Chicago Museum of Science and Industry, you kind of have to go and show up if there's an issue. So there's that as well. Yeah.
So a few years later, you end up starting a company, Ambient Devices. What were you doing there?
Yeah, so there's a group at the Media Lab where I ended up teaching called the Tangible Media Group. And they were exploring this idea, how could you take computation and kind of spread it more thinly around us in the environment? So instead of having a computer that does everything on a small screen, instead you take advantage of this fact that people have peripheral vision that can tune into a lot of information all around you. It's why we like pictures on the walls and windows in our offices, because you can perceive a lot more than just what's right in your foveal vision, right straight in front of you. So I became really interested in this idea of how could you start to render information that people care about in their cognitive periphery. So kind of a technical term, but there's this notion called pre-attentive processing. So your brain like processes all of this extra stuff without distracting you, doesn't distract the conversation, doesn't tax your cognitive pool, but you can kind of tell, a lot of other information that's around you. So it could be the color of something in your peripheral vision. It could be a pattern. It could be the speed of something. So at Ambient Devices, we created, the first product was called the Ambient Orb. And it basically looked like a grapefruit-sized glass ball. It's really beautiful. And you decided what thing you cared about that you wanted to kind of monitor throughout the day. Some people it was like the stock market. Other people it was the weather for tomorrow. Some people it was like whether the surf's up or when the next bus is coming or how many steps have you walked. So you have digital information and you're mapping it to this simple representation and then you're putting it kind of on a bookshelf or on a mantle or something. So that was the idea of Ambient Devices.
It reminds me of, like, I forget what number Boylston Street it is there, like flashing red storms ahead.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right. Right, so it's kind of already in architecture. Like, it's a beacon that shows you what the weather's going to be tomorrow or if the Red Sox have won. It also, like, remaps for that important information.
Yeah,
so we created, at Ambient Devices, we created about 7 or 8 products that were sold mostly through specialty retailers, like the Museum of Modern Art, or Brookstone, Sharper Image. We had one product at Best Buy, but all of them were kind of super simple displays that would show you something that you cared about to track throughout the day. So we had a little post-it note size product that tracked sports scores, another one that would track 5-day weather forecasts. You know, they used e-ink, kind of like super low battery power display technology. So it was just a little 3-inch like post-it note, magnetic on the back. You put it on your fridge. We actually engineered a protocol that went over a pager network in order to get data to the thing every 10 minutes. So you didn't need Bluetooth. You didn't need Wi-Fi. The, you know, installation experience was pop in batteries and then it would work. You know, pager networks are great because they have the frequency for 800 megahertz is like penetrates deeply into buildings. And that's why doctors still sometimes have pagers because they can kind of get messages in hospitals. So there were 8,000 towers and we built our own little protocol on top of that. And that powered all of these little orbs, beacons, post-it notes. We had something called the Ambient Dashboard that had 3 needles that would track any 3 things that you wanted, kind of like a car dashboard. So you could track like, when's my next meeting? Or what's the congestion on my homeward commute? People really love these products. I just emailed actually one of the other founders of that company and said, hey, we should, you know, bring back the orb. People should tell me if they want it back. It's kind of a notion of calm computing. You know, it doesn't require a lot of cognitive load. It's not like reading Twitter all day, but it does keep you informed.
That's cool. Do you end up getting acquired or how did you wind that up?
We realized a couple years in at Ambient Devices that if you put information in people's environment and make it kind of unavoidable, it's a behavior change mechanism as well. So in addition to just being a nice way to tune into things, if you track somebody's blood sugars, if they're diabetic, or the steps that they need to walk or that they have walked, people walk more steps. People take better care of their diabetes. People get crazy about trading in the stock market. Like whatever it is, for good or for ill, it changes people's behavior. So we realized we really have a behavior change object. And so we started another company just to pursue that focus. So Ambient Devices, still around, still doing energy monitoring, showing you how much consumption you have, how much you're paying for energy. They were working with a lot of, you know, PG&E and Southern California Edison. And then we started another company called Vitality that was just going after medication adherence as a start. So we realized there was this multi-billion opportunity for getting people who are taking some important medication to do it more regularly. So we started working with Novartis on hypertension. We worked with Harvard Center for Connected Health and did a study, a randomized control trial, where we gave people a pill bottle cap that fits on top of a normal amber medication vial, and it would signal you in kind of progressively obnoxious ways for you to take your meds. So it starts off with a little bit of pulsing light, and then it plays little cute arpeggios. These are right back to St. Olaf. We had did this warm-up, which was dun 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 dun. So every 5 minutes, it like adds another note to the arpeggio. Dun 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 dun. So eventually, it gets your attention, and you're like, oh, I guess I should go take that medication. So we got people from a baseline of 50-something% of the time taking their meds to 90-something% of the time. So it was like a 53-93 lift, which is huge because you avoid unnecessary hospitalizations. You make the pharma companies more money. and it's good for your health. And the pharmacies love it because you refill more often. In fact, we put, inspired by the OnStar system in the car that has a little button, there's a button in the bottom of the pill cap where you push that and you get a refill. You know, it was kind of an IoT device before Internet of Things was really a term, right? But this was again, the idea of kind of spreading information with the falling cost of computation, the falling cost of connectivity, kind of trying to sprinkle information and indication of information thinly around your life.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. For more information, visit syrinx.com. That's syrinx.com.
Now, was the connected pill cap, I imagine this one's not on the pager network. It's probably internet connected.
Yeah, we actually tried everything for this. We did one version was Bluetooth. People had a hard time setting it up. Another version connected to something that would plug into an Ethernet jack. The one that was most successful was actually you have a bunch of pill caps. They're all different colors. They all connect to a hub, which looks like a nightlight. We actually didn't even tell people that it was a cellular modem. So we did a deal with AT&T. It was like only $1 a month because there was almost no data. But there was an AT&T connected cell phone in a thing that looked like a nightlight. And we just said, oh, plug the nightlight in the same room where you keep your meds. And that, like, it was really simple. But I think that's kind of one of the secrets to being a technologist that is also a designer, that is also an entrepreneur, is you're really trying to find this moment where there's a technology readiness, there's an appetite for using a valuable service on the consumer side or business side. And you can also design it in such a way that people will use it. You know, people will say, oh yeah, I get this. This offers value to my life and I know how to set it up and it's not a pain in the ass to live with every day. And I don't have to charge it every day. That is really a balance of skill sets that entrepreneurs need.
The more invisible and ubiquitous you can make the technology, the better it is. Previous underserved guest, Eli Goldberg, talked about, you know, the intersection of people that can like configure a router and like need help with their meds. It's not a very big Venn diagram.
Yeah, right, right. You know, I just had an experience this morning with a buddy of mine. I'm now full into augmented reality and just thinking all about the different variations of how that can help people. And he just sent me a pair of glasses that are coming out at CES this year, the Consumer Electronics Show. They're called Active Look. They're built just for one particular job, which is if you're a runner and you have data that's being gathered about your pace and your heart rate, you don't have to pick up your arm and break stride and look at the data. So it projects it into one of the glasses that look like normal Oakleys. And it just projects it into a monocular view that appears to be about a meter out in front of you and that shows you this data. And I thought, wow, that's like, I like the focus of that use case. I like the price point. You know, I really want him to be successful. But the setup experience, man, like you have to associate the glasses with Bluetooth and then you have to go to your Garmin account and pick what the look is. And then you've got 4 or 5 steps that are all too complicated for normal people.
You know, hearing you describe that and imagining the use case, like I'm like, what other use cases could this be? All I can picture is people in combat, like being able to see like how far away is the enemy, like an overlay of a map.
You know, it turns out, I mean, actually, my most recent book, I know we're going sequential maybe, but I just want to jump ahead to, I've written 2 books. One is called Enchanted Objects, all about Internet of Things and kind of how normal the objects around us kind of want to have more information and want to become more animate. Like your umbrella should tell you, like, it's raining out today, David. Like, don't forget me. You know, like they can all kind of collude together on your behalf if they're all connected. But my most recent book is called Supersight, and it's all about computer vision and augmented reality. I think there's so many times that you want just a little bit of information to help you with navigation or understanding that you're in a risky situation and you know, other people have crashed into rocks around here. So if you're boating, like be extra careful right now. I hope we get into some of that kind of use cases for how we'll see differently in the future.
Very cool. So you got a company, you start another company while you're still there. It seems like you are kind of one of those people that can have like 4 or 5 different things going on at one time. And you talked on the pre-call about the portfolio approach to a job. What is that?
Well, I think I've always enjoyed having one foot in teaching and another foot in being an entrepreneur. And I think there are a lot of people at MIT that do this. The teaching world means that You can explore new ideas. You can prototype a lot of things quickly. Thanks to your students. you can pick off, which I've done in multiple companies, kind of your favorite and best students in order to recruit them into your company. So you certainly get a lot of advantages from being in an academic setting. On the other hand, having another foot in entrepreneurship means that when you go back in to give a lecture, you have lots of real examples from real world problems that real companies have. So you can be a lot more grounded and a lot more authentic when it comes to being a better teacher. And I think most of the time, the companies that I found or that I work with kind of appreciate that somebody has that kind of blended background. You're not only an academic and you're not only an entrepreneur. And I often think about this in terms of other parts of your life. I think it's good to be on both sides of the table and kind of oscillate back and forth. So my mental model of this is a little bit like an atom, where you have molecules that are kind of oscillating around the center of the atom. I think you want to be always kind of teaching as well as learning. You always want to be mentoring as well as having a mentor. So being a mentee, you always want to be, if you can, investing in new companies, like being an angel, but also having something that you're working on that is worthy of somebody else's investment. That's the way I want to kind of move through the world, is kind of always being able to kind of be orbiting these different modes. And I really enjoy the ping-ponging back and forth across, you know, different ideas and different companies. I think one of the reasons why people love consulting, or that they hire people from IDEO or Design Continuum, is because you see a lot of examples of something. And so you can be a better pattern matcher.
Yeah, the kind of going back and forth, some people seem to have like an ego problem with it. Like, once I am a mentor, I could not be a mentee, you know? Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. you know, once I am a teacher, why would I be the student? And, you know, I agree with you that, you know, you can't be afraid to get your hands dirty, and you can't be afraid to be humble and potentially feel like a beginner at something, or flip the script and say, you know what, I'm going to be a little bit vulnerable here, but I'll learn a lot from it and I'll be better off for it.
Yeah, I think that's just it, Andrew. You really want like a beginner's mind when you come into things, and you want that humility. Yeah, I think it's like builds brain plasticity, which we all need, especially in our 50s.
Amen. As a barbecue competitor, you know, we would hand in these barbecue boxes to judges, and I said, well, I wonder what it's like to be a judge. So I went and took the certified barbecue judge course and judged some barbecue competitions, which, oh my God, that's a lot of meat to eat. It's like 24 bites, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it's a lot. Mm. But you quickly learn, like, all right, well, what's important to these people? And then how could I be a better competitor?
Yeah, I just got some feedback from a potential investor for this marine camera system that I'm working on. And he said, you know, your slide deck, I've just been dumping like pictures of the works like prototypes, pictures of the contract manufacturer over in Norway, pictures of the team, pictures of the on-water testing. I've just kind of used my pitch deck as a place just to dump things that I want to show to my current investors. And I took this new investor, potential new investor, through this, you know, 40 side long. I thought it was really interesting. He's like, what are you doing? Like, you need to boil this down to 12 or 15 slides max. And I'm like, you're so right. I really, you know, and you learn that if you oscillate back and forth on both sides of the table, you like most of the time don't make mistakes like I just made.
Now, you are a fellow glasses wearer and spent some time at Warby Parker. What were you doing there?
Yeah, so I was recruited by the founders. I didn't go, you know, this was a few years after the company was founded. There are a couple of guys out of Wharton, but they approached me based on healthcare background and also physics and optics understanding. When you're an online glasses retailer like Warby, you have this important moment, which is people fall in love with a frame and then they don't know what their prescription is. And if they have to go to the corner optician, they may lose the sale. That is, Warby may lose the sale because the optician's attach rate is usually about 60% or 70%. So what we built was a system where you can go to a website, it puts up an eye test on your laptop. You then hold up your phone and it steps you back using computer vision to a very precise distance away from the laptop. And then you give yourself an eye test from home. And then we send that data. We test you at different distances. And we send that data to an ophthalmologist who's passed the boards in that state by law, and then they will write you a new script. So this was a really important product for Warby Parker to be able to maintain this flow of people try on frames, they like frames, they can actually fill them, and then those are sent directly to their house. So that was the first project, was this new business of online eye testing. And then I was head of R&D, really trying to answer this question about, well, what is the future of glasses? Like, this, obviously, computers are becoming smaller, more powerful, more energy efficient. And so we're seeing this in terms of wearables, like the Aura Ring, which tracks everything. You know, have you seen the Aura Ring? Mm-hmm. Amazing. Like, all, like, in the format of a chunky wedding ring, but it has batteries that last 5 days. It tracks sleep, it tracks movement, it tracks temperature. So if you can do that in a ring, you can certainly put a lot of tech into the frames of glasses as well. So we were thinking about, how could we create a new set of services around knowing where someone is, what they're looking up? It could be a tourist situation where, like, if you look up, they answer questions about the tower you're looking up at. Could you make a an exercise game that's based in glasses, that knows how much you're walking and talks to you as you're doing it, kind of like AirPods Pros meet glasses? Actually, Bose has a product out right now called Bose AR, which is just an audio-based experience. But there's also all kinds of, like, very small pico projection systems that, similar to those running glasses, can put information and blend information between what you see and a computer layer. And so we're very interested in kind of exploring what would be some of those services and how could we help people with that type of technology.
So I'm not just a Warby Parker fan, I'm also a client. And when I went to go use them, like, I liked the home try-on of the frames and everything. And then I went to get my prescription, and the doctor was pretty willing to write that out. But then as soon as I said, I need to know my pupillary distance.
Right, your PD.
Yeah, the distance between the center of my left pupil and the center of my right pupil, he got cranky. Like, he knew exactly what I was going to do with that, which was go online and buy glasses.
Right. Well, when I was at Warby Parker, thanks to the iPhone 10 coming out at the time, we were able to figure out your pupillary distance, the shape and dimensions of your head. And so actually, it's the same technology that unlocks your phone with your face that Apple acquired. And so we could make face measuring service and also a virtual try-on service, so that it's been an award-winning product for them. And really, I mean, for COVID, it was, like, very prescient kind of thing to do. So people hold up their phone. It shows them the front-facing camera, the picture of their face. It superimposes glasses that look very realistic, even crystal and other things that are hard to render, look very realistic on top of your face. And people have the confidence after using that experience to buy direct, which is, I think, kind of a big deal, because I think it's that virtual try-on for Warby Parker is really one of the kind of watershed moments for how could you measure the body and show somebody in something, whether it's jewelry or shoes or clothing or something, with enough fidelity, verisimilitude, whatever you want to call it, so that they have the confidence to actually, you know, do an e-com transaction right then and there. And we're seeing that. I mean, that was a few years ago. We're seeing that come to Cartier for jewelry, watches, Nike for shoes. So it's not just, like, Wayfair and Amazon and IKEA landing couches in your living room anymore, but it's really things that are not only rigid, they are attached to a body, which is very non-rectilinear, and also things that flow, right? So, like, dresses and scarves and that kind of stuff is next.
I am altering the scope of the project. Pray I don't alter it any further.
Excellent. Let the scope creep flow. Keep adding features.
To deploy the release, deliver first. You must.
I find your lack of faith in change management disturbing.
Missing your deadline is the path to the dark side.
If you or someone you know manages software development projects, we can help. Call the offices of Syrinx Consulting. Syrinx provides software consultants who hit the ground running to help you deliver right away. Our toll-free number is 888-579-7469, option 1. Or you can live chat with Berg at Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com.
Syrinx is not a law office, and this is not legal advice. Offer valid only in the United States. Hablamos español, pero solo un poco y no tener ni pies ni cabeza. Saludos.
So I noted that you're a keynote speaker on the metaverse, but I think you're not so much talking about Mark Zuckerberg's baby as how augmented reality is helping us overcome this deficit of imagination, like with the Warby Parker try-on.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I really like the definition of the metaverse as it's this virtual but spatialized way of experiencing information. So, and by spatialized, not just in virtual spaces, but in the real world, in real space. So if you think about like all of the information that Wikipedia has, what would it mean rather than just getting that through a mobile phone? What would it mean to apply and distribute that information, anchor that information to everything that it needs to be anchored to in the world, right? Like every tree has a name and a background. Every person has a bio. Every object that you're shopping for, every thing in a national park, you know, every historical thing, you know, if you could take all of that information and attach it to those places and then either hold up your phone or wear these glasses and be able to see this layer of digital information on the analog world, that's what's really exciting for me about the real world metaverse, as I call it.
So you're involved with a couple companies now that are kind of making that a reality, right?
Yeah, they're both ambitious. One is trying to, you know, make a digital twin of every landscape in America. So there are 53 million homes in America. And so one of the companies is called Home Outside. The aspiration is, how do we get people to have enough confidence that they will plant trees, install bushes and hedges and outdoor furniture and lighting, and really create more space that's usable in the yards that they already have? So, you know, a lot of homes have enough space to host a barbecue or host a fire pit or give you a chair to get away from your family that's like at the edge of the property, or, you know, or a swing out front so you kind of have more of a more social interaction. There's so much potential in the land that's right around us. And again, like this failure of imagination problem that I talk about in my book Supersight, is a lot of people can't imagine how amazing that could look. You know, I mean, it's kind of a hard thing to fathom. You know, it's hard if you're not trained as a landscape architect or a city planner. You know, it's kind of hard to look at most people's front yards or an empty parking lot and say, oh, I could see what this could be, you know. But if you have augmented reality and you have these tools, these algorithms that can measure the space, understand the existing conditions, know where you are in the world, know the sun exposure and the soil and the all of the other things that are important for putting in, for installing these landscapes, then people can hold up their phones and they can see it. And they can also heart it, or, you know, like different parts of it or swap in new things. You know, we think of it at the company, we call it a 3D configurator. So it's a little bit like the 3D car configurator, except rather than just having a car on a white background, it's your house has been digitally reconstructed in a game engine. We're using Unreal Engine, which like runs most of the games in America, in the world.
That was my guess.
Yeah. And so we can be incredibly high poly count. It can look incredibly realistic, some like cinema quality. And then we can drop in like shade trees and hedges and border gardens. And people are like, wow, this looks amazing. And then this is kind of the manipulative part of what we're doing. I say that with kind of a quotes, which is, we have a set of landscaping values, like let's use less water. Let's actually save bees. Let's have shade trees so you don't spend as much on cooling your house in the winter. So we have like a bunch of things that we kind of believe everybody should do. And so we show you a great design with all of those kind of values embedded in it. So that's one company. So that's kind of making a digital twin of the world, of the land-based world. And the other company is making a digital twin of the water world. So this is a company called Clearwater. And we're using all of the cartography, all of the maps, the data elevation models for what's underneath the water, and showing you as if the water's clear. That's why the company's called Clearwater. So you get to hold up your phone or use glasses, or we have a camera system that goes on tops of boats, and it looks as if the water's clear. So you see the underwater structure, you see the rocks. If you're in the fog, you see the virtual buoys are installed and virtual ships are that are heading towards you are evident. So we're kind of giving you the picture that you need in order to make better decisions and have more confidence on the water and be safer on the water.
Does that exist for airplanes already?
Aspects of it do, yeah. And the military has been using these kind of systems for targeting for a long time, or having you avoid a missile that's heading towards you. And it's actually one of the most interesting and advanced kind of prototyping spaces for AR, because you are completely sensory saturated. One of my students at MIT was doing a project. This was a decade ago, so I think I could talk about it. Where he was trying to think about, your visual field is already very saturated. Everything you're doing with your hands is already very saturated in terms of just input and output. They're already using haptics in the hands. He was coming up with like a butt haptic system that would change the texture of the seat you're sitting on if you're flying over a dangerous area. And I thought, like, oh, wow, you're really pushing the limits of kind of IO for the body if now
You're sitting on pins and needles. You're
sitting on pins and needles. Exactly, right. But like, how else are you going to tell somebody that they're, you know, flying over some, that they need to be careful on their left flank, you know, if you're already filling the visual field and the hands with all this information? So what I've seen also in aeronautics is, if you're flying into an airport and you're on IFR, instrument flight rating, they sometimes put up these tubes in certain all digital cockpits so that you can get a sense of whether you're high or low or just flying down the tube you need to fly. And we've actually taken kind of inspiration from those tubes and also drone racing, so that when drone racing, you're like flying under these hoops. Mm. It looks a little bit like Tour de France, right? Where you get to the summit and they have this like blow up arch that you cross under. So in the water world, where there are these lateral channel buoys, like out of Quincy or in all over the world, you have these like red right returning kind of thing, right? So you have channel buoys, you try to stay between them because that's where it's been dredged or that's where it's safe. And people don't know whether they're returning or not returning when they're crossing Boston Harbor. So there's this real need for kind of connecting those. So we have these kind of parabolic arches that are in AR that like attach to both sides of these lateral channel buoys.
Fly under here with your boat.
Exactly. Right. But there are lots of opportunities. We're also marking wildlife. Like, this is where the whale is. This is where the turtles are. This is where the manatee is. Like, don't run over this stuff. And we're also doing this. We're, you know, inspired by Waze. We're making a cloud so that if one boat that has a thermal camera sees a log, that data is cast up into the cloud and other boats that are coming that way can benefit from one boat as a probe or as a spotter, and they can avoid that object. Of course, we have to track and predict how it's going to drift, but in some ways, that's being done for man overboard situations. So that's kind of a known algorithm.
Sounds like Waze for the seas.
Yeah, Waze for water.
Oh, yeah. That's cool. You also had a story about how you helped a construction company with X-ray vision flashlights.
Yeah, so this was one of my students. I've been teaching at the Media Lab and also at the Copenhagen Interaction Design Institute, which is a really cool place. And one of my students from Copenhagen, we were talking about augmented reality and talking about kind of the problem with glasses is people don't know what you're looking at. We have a hard time collaborating if we're standing side by side, even if we're both wearing AR glasses, because I can't see what you're seeing. And we're probably going to choose different layers. That's different with data projection. So if you have, like at the Media Lab, we have this city that has three data projectors that are all shining information down at this little virtual dollhouse kind of city. Some of that data is walkability score or access to amenities or diversity. So you can like move the city around and see how the data changes. But everyone, you can get a group of 20 people standing around the table and they know that they're all looking at the same metadata because it's projected onto the world. So we were talking about this in Copenhagen, and one of the students said, well, that's kind of like a flashlight. Yeah, that's brilliant. Like you could put a pico projector in a flashlight form, and if it had a building information model baked in and a gyro and a compass, then you could do this fantasy that everyone has, which is X-ray vision. So you shine the quote flashlight at the wall. It knows what the electrical runs and the plumbing runs and, you know, knows what's behind the wall. And then you get this fantasy of, you know, the X-ray view of the thing you're shining the flashlight on, and everyone can see it, right? Because you can be standing next to the contractor and standing next to the building manager, and like you can all like have this same view of the world.
That's cool. So that's actually commercialized?
It's a startup. They're called Lumen. It's lumen.world, and they're working hard on right now. They have a deal with Meow Wolf, which is an escape room. And so, you know, there you can use the flashlight in the escape room to like find clues and find keys and find hints, and That's what they're doing now.
That's cool. Now, what is the conversational balance table?
Right. So when I was at the Media Lab a few years ago, I started working with an architecture firm called Gensler, one of the biggest architecture firms in the world. And they were building a set of new offices for Salesforce. And they came by the Media Lab and said, you know, we like this idea of ambient computing, of spreading information around the environment. Like, how could that be useful in a work setting? And I just read this book by Susan Cain called Quiet. One of the main points of Susan Cain's book is in a work environment, you have introverts and extroverts, and the extroverts dominate the conversation, and the organization doesn't benefit from all the great ideas that the introverts have, because the extroverts are just masking and covering up the ability for those ideas to get let out. So, you know, if you're facilitating a meeting or a workshop, the facilitator's job is to kind of like tap down the extroverts and kind of pull ideas from the introverts. But I thought, how could we embed a real-time display, an ambient display in a conference room that would make people kind of more self-aware of this dynamic that happens in all, you know, in all meetings? And the thing that we prototyped was a table and six kind of facets on the table. There's a little microphone that's array that's disguised underneath the table. And then on the surface of the table, you see this little light constellation, almost like a star constellation, that gradually fades up in front of you as you talk. But it's slow enough so that after 20 minutes or so, you can kind of glance down at the table and you can see like, oh, he hasn't said anything and she's been totally dominating the conversation. So it's a super subtle way of getting people to just be like a little bit more self-aware of like, what's the pie chart of contributions here? And we found that if we could do this in a subtle enough way, people would really appreciate and respond and not really feel, you know, shame or self-conscious.
Now, you had also figured out a good use for a technology that is the bane of my existence with three teenage daughters, Snapchat filters.
You know, if you think about how AR is being used today, like what is the most successful examples of superimposing information over the world? There are two things that come to mind. One is Pokemon Go, the game, right? Which is still like a huge success, even though most people think biggest numbers were 3 or 4 years ago. Actually, they continue to grow and grow and grow. And the other one is Snapchat filters, which are used by hundreds of millions of people multiple times a day. So Snapchat, actually, they have a conference yesterday and today called Lens World, I think. So they're trying to get more makers to build lenses that can be anchored to a face or anchored to a body or anchored to like a statue or a landmark in the world, like a Eiffel Tower. And so the way that we're using this in the healthcare, there's this real misunderstanding about kind of how your body is doing in certain disease states. So if you're diabetic, people are like, oh, that's like a blood sugars thing. But no, it actually like affects your circulatory system and your kidneys and your ability to concentrate. So our idea is something that we've prototyped. We're doing this with a large healthcare provider, is how would you kind of make a Snapchat filter which you can either put your phone down and then see how you're doing. So it mines all of your chart data, your healthcare data, and then it kind of lights up different parts of your body to show you these are the systems that are going to be an issue in the future for you based on your healthcare data. You know, a lot of people that are a little bit overweight don't realize that one of the biggest taxes or consequences of that is not only heart health, but also joint health. So like carrying around a little bit of extra weight probably means you're going to get two new knees and probably, you know. And so I think it can be kind of a mirror for people to understand themselves and to kind of see the consequences, you know, to kind of fathom the future of something that's a little bit hard to imagine right now. The point of the ninth chapter of the book, Supersight, is really try to ask the question of, if we need to see something better, if our eyes need to evolve, like, what is that thing that we need to see, right? Is it, what are we a little bit myopic about today? And obviously, like, kind of future consequences of decisions we're making today is something that's really kind of hard to consider. We've all got a kind of a blind spot for that. I eat just as much late night ice cream as anybody else and, you know, kind of struggle with that behaviors. But, you know, I think AR has a big role to play when it comes to helping us see things anew, you know, helping us, you know, see what could this intersection look like in a way that prioritized people and bikes and not cars. You know, what could this office park look like if we really wanted to, you know, kind of replant it and add solar? There are a lot of situations in the world that need a little bit of visualization. I think AR can do that.
Now, you were not content to just go get a smart things and add a few Z-Wave switches in your home. You've done some full-scale hacking to merge the world of apps and furniture.
I feel like the furniture industry really needs to start partnering. Furniture and lighting needs to start partnering with the world of technology and connectivity in order to really change, like, how we encounter technology. Like, we've become a little bit stuck, I think, in smartphones and smartwatches. And I think this technology could be a lot more elegantly presented, a lot easier to use, and a lot more beautiful, kind of, if the furniture companies and lighting companies and people that make wallpaper and light switches, you know, kind of could deliver information in more subtle, more bespoke ways. At the Media Lab, I've been prototyping kind of a line of furniture. It's called ambient furniture. It's a coffee table that listens to the conversation and shows photos that are relevant. It's a cabinetry for your kitchen or for your kid's bedroom that allows them to open a cabinet and get an immediate Skype connection to a loved one that's remote, like a parent, your parent, their grandparent. It's a doorbell that not only knows who's downstairs or outside, but kind of who's heading home, you know, who's kind of on their way and without having to send a text message while you drive, which is useful for lots of reasons.
My wife broke the geofence.
She'll
be here soon.
Actually, it's a series of geofences, and each of them plays kind of a different version of a tune, like as somebody is kind of homebound. So everybody in the family gets their own tune, kind of like Peter and the Wolf. And dun 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 dun. You know, it's like so. I really love collaborations that involve a company that already sells something into people's homes and is trusted and, you know, an established brand that makes an umbrella that needs to be smarter or cabinetry or kitchen appliances or other things. And so much of it, I think, is really badly done. It requires an app and requires learning and care and feeding. And we're kind of all sick of hearing about, like, oh, you've got like an internet connected what now? But I feel like we're in this transitional phase where, yes, there are lots of ugly examples of internet connected objects in the world. But when laser printers first came out and we all were given the world of typography, like, it was pretty ugly for about a decade there too. But while we were all like using Gil, you know, San Francisco, whatever font. So I feel like as a society, we are all going through this kind of trough of disillusionment right now. And I think on the other side will come like lots of elegantly designed, useful, award-winning kind of things that will be imbued with connectivity and computation, but not look like phones.
Well, David was kind enough to bring me a copy of Supersight, which I'm definitely going to check out. And what else should folks look for if they pick up their own copy?
Well, they should go to supersight.world. There are a bunch of videos there that are projects that use augmented reality, I think, in ways that really are useful. Speaking of, an app goes with that. I did an app with the book, and there are about 80 things in the book that have a little glyph next to them, a little 3D square. And so if you, Harry Potter, like, hold your phone up to a picture, it might trigger a TED talk or a podcast or a piece of software or a demo of something. And so this, you know, hacking the the format of the book was part of this process, or part of this adventure for writing this book. Because, you know, a book is kind of an old medium. So I thought, well, how could we have the audio version of the book so you could toggle back and forth between the reading and listening, or jump into a podcast kind of midway through the book? Or I have some design principles at the end of the book. And I thought, oh, well, I can't say I'm done with all the design principles for augmented reality. So one of the design principles is make an old medium like print more relevant and fresh by using augmented reality. So if you hold up your phone to the end of those design principles, it gives you more design principles. So I was able to kind of publish the book without finishing it using augmented reality.
What is the camera system you brought with us? For the audio listeners, it's kind of a triangular system, black and white. Tell us about it.
Sure. Well, this is the Lookout Cam. Every boater needs a Lookout. That's kind of a mantra in sailing. So this is a 360-degree, seven-camera system that goes up on the mast of the sailboat, or just on the top of your center console boat. And it has a stereo camera in the front that sees forward. It has two rear cameras that are very wide angle and stitch a 360-degree view. So computer vision is applied to that 360-degree stitch, so you can see if there's a jet ski coming at you from your left rear.
There always is.
There's night vision camera, and there's a super high-res camera on the front, so you can get kind of a binocular-like view. So the faster you go, the further out you can see. There's a GPU, a graphical processing unit, and CPU embedded. So you basically take the output of this camera system and you plug it into the display that's already sitting at the helm of the boat. And then you get a virtual view on top of the real view that the camera system provides. So you see the real world from that vantage at the right field of view for whatever you're doing, whether you're docking or sitting there or driving fast. And then we superimpose over that virtual buoys, safe passage tracks, points of interest, where other people report the whales are. So all of that is kind of a virtualized view on top of the real view that the Lookout camera provides.
That sounds like an even cooler water world view than I see on my Tesla on land.
Well, interesting. I just got the FSD, what is it called? Full self-driving, Tesla. And it is also making in real time a 3D virtual view of whatever that intersection is or whatever it is in front of you. In the case of Tesla, they're not showing you the real world underneath that virtual view, but it simplifies the virtual view. But for the water world, we're kind of doing both. We're showing you the best view for the moment, for the context, and then also the AR layers on top of that. And someday this will be glasses. You know, we're building it in Unity. So you can download it, clearwater.ar, on the App Store today. So you can kind of get a little bit of this in an iOS app. But I think kind of the future of AR is it's on phones, yes. It's in projections. It's on normal screens that like backup cameras. It's on windshields. And eventually, all of those are kind of prototypes for the future of glasses and contacts.
So David, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your amazing experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
Andrew, I've really enjoyed the conversation. This has been a blast.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.